Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Romesh Badani. Romesh is the founder of Bridge.us, which is an online platform which helps speed up the immigration process. Romesh, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Romesh, when you first told me the revenue that you're making from the online platform, I was really amazed. So what was it? Let me start with that. What is your revenue in 2016?
What I can tell you is that we're north of $1 million this year in revenue.
Yeah.
And that represents a 3 to 4x increase over our 2015 figures.
That's amazing. And what does your platform do for someone who doesn't know it yet? Can you describe in more detail what the platform does?
Sure. So Bridge is an end-to-end provider of immigration legal services. We're the easiest way for companies to navigate through this otherwise complex process. So we combine legal expertise of some of the top immigration attorneys in the country with a proprietary software solution that we've developed to help streamline a lot of the more administrative and cumbersome parts of the process. So we're really sitting at the intersection of the legal industry and technology to make the immigration process efficient and transparent for both companies and their foreign national employees.
So if I'm a company and I'm willing to hire a foreign national, I would hire Bridge.us as my service provider. Do you have to hire another lawyer also, or does it all come in your one umbrella?
That's a good question. So it's a one-stop shop. So when you come to Bridge and use us as your provider, you're not only getting access to some of the top immigration attorneys in the country, you're also getting a technology-enabled solution to make your life easier. If you come to us, we'll take care of everything from initiation of the case all the way through to approval and throughout the life cycle of that foreign national's history.
So let's, before we go into the details about how you build the company, let's step back a little bit and talk about your life when you were growing up. You told me earlier that you are used to seeing a lot of family members go through the immigration process as you're growing up, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, my father was the first of five children in his family to immigrate to the U.S. My mother was the first of eight children to immigrate to the U.S. They've now been here for over 30 years. But really every year of my youth, and even continuing to today, my family's been going through an immigration process, whether that's for my parents all the way through to becoming citizens themselves, my grandparents, uncles, cousins. And I've seen the highs and lows, right? Mm-hmm. I've seen, you know, the American dream of, you know, kind of seeing my own parents and their rise through the immigration process. I've also seen, you know, cousins of mine getting kicked out of the country the day before they were supposed to walk for their graduation. So I've seen, you know, what inspires me is sort of these stories and, you know, being able to see both the positives but also the areas for improvement in our immigration process.
Wow. Why was your cousin kicked out of the country the day before graduation?
The short answer is an attorney made a small administrative mistake on his application. So he was eligible, but he was denied and therefore out of status and literally had to leave the country, go back to the UK, where he was a UK and an Indian citizen. Mm-hmm. And he literally could not participate in his own, you know, he went to the University of California at Irvine, a great school, and could not be a part of that graduation. So that was a pretty impactful moment, I think, for me in seeing, you know, because until that point, most of the immigration process, while it was cumbersome and time consuming and expensive for my family, most of the times it had resulted in positive outcomes. And that was the first time where you do all this work, you spend, you know, years and years going through and navigating this process and thinking you have everything sort of down to a science. And then you have sort of a minor administrative hiccup that really have nothing to do with the candidacy or the eligibility of a candidate,
yeah,
and suddenly sort of turning someone's life upside down. So, you know, it's moments like those, and we continue to obviously see that when we
yeah.
have clients coming to us whose immigration processes have been screwed up.
Yeah, I can see why it can be frustrating. When I was on my H-1 visa, there was a time when an attorney, the legal team, HR team in my company called me to an office room, and they said they made a small mistake on my application, and I had to leave the country. And this was a Wednesday evening, and I asked them, how much time do I have? They told me I had to leave the country by Friday.
Wow.
And I went to an external attorney. I figured out a way around it, and I ended up not leaving. It worked out okay in the end. But those 2 to 3 days was extremely frustrating, and I can imagine what your cousin must have gone through and what impact it
yeah,
had
absolutely.
On you.
There's no, I always say that there's no small mistakes in immigration. So everything kind of gets magnified. You know, a small strategic difference could be the difference in a successful case and a not successful case. So the stakes are just so incredibly high.
You were working after your graduation from your undergrad in the finance industry, and you worked there for several years, and you got
mm-hmm.
into Harvard for an MBA. And during an MBA, you did a summer internship at ZocDoc. What was ZocDoc about?
Sure. So for those of us who don't know ZocDoc, ZocDoc is an online healthcare marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's now the largest online healthcare marketplace that helps connect patients to providers, doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that in a pretty interesting way. So traditionally, you know, you open up the yellow pages, or you have a relationship with the doctor and you give them a call. You have to call them during office hours. You have this frustrating process of scheduling an appointment. You don't know a whole lot about that doctor. So it's a process that's full of friction.
Mm-hmm.
And what ZocDoc has done, and it's a fairly simple model, interestingly, they brought that all online.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the first to basically build a marketplace of providers all over the country in different specialties. And as a patient, you can come in, enter your insurance information, and get connected to doctors, be able to book appointments online, be able to read reviews from other patients, and basically help streamline the process of connecting to doctors.
Yeah. You were in the finance industry for 4 or 5 years before that. Like people usually who go into MBA schools, they go after like private equity and
right.
other things which pay like very well. Why did you choose to go to ZocDoc instead?
It's a great question. I had the, like you said, I spent about 4 years prior to my MBA in investment banking and then in private equity, and actually had an offer to go back as a vice president at the firm that I was at previously. They would have paid for my MBA, all those great things. But ultimately, while I thoroughly enjoyed that experience and wouldn't have traded it for anything else, I think for me, it was about the opportunity to build something from the ground up,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to, you know, where I was before, which is mostly working with, you know, multi-billion-dollar companies, and really, you know, engineering either a buyout or some sort of M&A or equity transaction.
Got it.
So the opportunity to build something, I think, is the short answer, and build something that had impact, right? I've always been fascinated by the role that technology can play in just about every industry. And ZocDoc happened to be in the healthcare industry, but it helped me see the light in terms of the opportunity for technology in the professional services industry more broadly.
So when you went to your internship, you already had... Oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off. I thought you were finished with what you were saying, so I let you finish. I'm sorry.
No, that was it. I was just saying that's where I sort of cut my teeth on, you know, sort of this intersection of technology and professional services.
Mm-hmm. Usually I have the video on, and this time we don't, so I find it hard to see when you're done versus when you're not.
No problem.
So at that time when you went for internship, you wanted to get a startup experience. It seemed like you already had ideas of starting your own.
You know, yes and no. I mean, I certainly tinkered with, during my first year in business school, I started a medical device company, basically got teamed up with some engineers at Johns Hopkins who were building a really interesting medical device for the spinal fusion process, really make it less painful to get a spinal fusion surgery. And they really needed someone to help with the commercial efforts. So I spent a good chunk of my first year as an MBA building that business. And then joined ZocDoc between my first and second year. I wouldn't say that I knew necessarily that I wanted to start a business. Mm-hmm. It's always been an interest, but I always think that, for someone to go in and just say, I want to start a business, mm-hmm. that's not enough. That shouldn't be the inspiration for starting a company, being your own boss and those types of things. It has to be a problem that you actually care about solving.
Yeah.
So it's not, and if that happens to be a problem that you can solve by starting a business, great, you should do it. But for me, it was much more sort of an exploratory period for those 2 years of touching a lot of different things, meeting a lot of different people, and obviously having the resources of a school like Harvard Business School. And I was able to experiment in a pretty low risk way, right? The downside would be that I get an MBA, which is a pretty good win. Mm-hmm. And the upside was that I discover something that I'm really passionate about. And, fortunately, that's what ended up happening.
So you finished your internship at ZocDoc and you went back to school. And how did Bridge.us or whatever the initial name was at that time, how did that come about?
Yeah, so our initial name was LexSpot.
LexSpot.
It was, this was the fall of 2011. And like you said, I just finished up my internship at ZocDoc, coming back to school. Everyone is kind of, as you were describing before, everyone's sort of in the rat race of, looking for jobs post-graduation at that point. We're in our second year. People are interviewing for consulting jobs and investment banking jobs and private equity jobs and really a lot of Silicon Valley kind of technology jobs as well. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, I was really passionate about what ZocDoc opened my eyes up to was this, like I said, this intersection of technology and professional services. Mm-hmm. And while I wasn't necessarily interested in the healthcare industry, that I felt like, technology was doing a fairly decent role there, I was interested in some of these other analogs to the ZocDoc model. And so I started looking at different verticals like healthcare. Mm-hmm. I was looking at legal, I was looking at real estate, I was looking at tax, all these different verticals that have similar challenges and similar processes as what I'd seen at ZocDoc. And about that time, I was actually approached by an attorney who's sort of a recent graduate of law school. He actually found me. He lived in Boston. His name was Chris Shaw. And Chris approached me and said, hey, I see you have this experience at ZocDoc. I've been thinking of, as a lawyer, I've seen the challenges of accessing clients. I've seen the challenges that clients have in finding lawyers. I'm thinking of building something similar to ZocDoc, but in the legal space, mm-hmm. basically a marketplace to help consumers find and connect with lawyers. And, I know you know a lot about that. Would love to grab coffee and just talk about it, right? And that sort of kicked off a relationship between Chris and I. Where we started sharing, comparing notes about the opportunity. I started telling him about kind of how ZocDoc worked and how I helped it grow. He started telling me and educating me about the legal market. And we saw an opportunity around this kind of ZocDoc for lawyers concept.
I see. And you were the business guy and Chris is a lawyer, right? And who was, what was your plan for how to like build this product? Because both of you are not developers, right?
That's right. That's right. So we hit this crossroads where we said, yeah, sounds like a good idea that's worth pursuing or at least running some experiments against. And we sort of looked at each other and said, okay, well, who's going to build this? And we knew from the start that this had to be something that we weren't going to contract this out and make this a non-core part of our team. It actually needed We needed a co-founder who was technical and could help us build. And then we started a search for that role, started talking to people in the rather small kind of Boston startup ecosystem, which has since gotten a lot bigger, but at the time was quite small. And one of Chris's old bosses actually knew Forrest, kind of serendipitous or small startup world in Boston, and mentioned that Forrest was at Google. Forrest is my co-founder and CTO now, but Forrest was at Google after Google had acquired its previous company, ITA Software, which is a large airline travel search company. So Google had just bought ITA. He was about 6 months into the gig at Google, and he was ready for something new. He was ready to leave kind of the big infrastructure of Google and really start building something from the ground up. And so we started talking to him. And what was interesting about Forrest was that he's the cynic that's going to make sure your idea is vetted before he's just going to jump in with blind faith. And so he kind of put us to the test. He said, okay, yeah, you guys seem like reasonably smart guys, but I'm not doing this unless you prove to me that there's some market demand for this idea around ZocDoc for lawyers. Right? Do lawyers really need to do this? Are they willing to pay for this? He started asking some of these questions. And so kind of the next step for us to actually get Forrest on board,
time was it? This was December 2011 or early 2012?
Yeah, this was late 2011, and sort of bled into early 2012 in terms of kind of this next step of having to convince him that we were legit. And so he, kind of late 2011, he said, go out and find me 20 lawyers that will commit to paying for this service. And, that was a pretty tough task, right? You're talking about a product that doesn't exist, and you're going to go ask lawyers to commit to paying $250 a month or $3,000 a year for some unknown benefits for a little startup that wasn't even incorporated yet. So he really sort of put that target out there. And that's how, basically spent the next month and a half or 2 months going either door to door or picking up the phone in Boston, trying to talk to lawyers in different verticals and convince them that our marketing platform was the solution for them and that it was the next big thing and the way they were going to grow their practice.
How do you choose $250 a month for the lawyers to pay? How do you come up with that price point?
I wish it was more scientific, but the reality is this was what doctors were paying on ZocDoc. Listed the same pricing model. We said, okay, this seems, lawyers and doctors have some similar characteristics, although the nature of their practices is very different and the size of the transaction is very different. We just started with that as a starting point, and we wanted to see if there was pushback or, of course, we were willing to make adjustments as we went along.
Got it. So what would you pitch to the lawyers at that time? This was early 2012 when you call a lawyer. What would you say your services were at that time?
Yeah, what I basically said is that LexSpot is an online marketplace to help clients, prospective clients, find and connect with lawyers in a more efficient and transparent way. So whereas today, what lawyers were used to was paying a lot of money for, billboards and yellow page ads and all these sort of antiquated forms of marketing. And they were paying a lot of money and they weren't really seeing a return. And most lawyers, frankly, are struggling to find a full book of business, right? There's a heavy supply of lawyers and the demand for legal services, especially as folks like LegalZoom and these kind of technology-enabled solutions enter the market, there was some stress in terms of the ability for lawyers to basically have a full book. So our pitch to them was, we're going to bring you clients, plain and simple, right? We're going to help bring you clients, and here's how. And we'd show them either through a screen share or literally a PowerPoint deck. We'd show them mock-ups of the site, and here's exactly what this is going to look like. They're going to book an appointment. You're going to have this very efficient solution that's not going to take you a lot of time. And, here are the different legal verticals that we'll advertise you for. And that was, that was the pitch early on, was just, we're going to bring you clients.
And you signed up, did you end up signing 20 doctors before you launched your first version of the product?
We scratched and clawed and we got there. Yeah, we got to 20, and obviously before we launched, we were signing up additional lawyers as we continued to build the product. But to get Forrest to commit, we needed those 20 commitments. We got there, and then we, as Forrest was building the product, I continued to sort of pound away and try to get lawyers to commit. And by the time we launched, we were, I believe, at 40 attorneys at the time that we launched. Continued to add some from there, but 40 attorneys at $250 a month was basically a decent run rate to get us going. And then, of course, the challenge there was growing from that point forward.
I see. So it was slightly over $10,000 a month when you first launched, which was in
Exactly.
April, is that right? April
That's
2012.
exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So one thing
spring
I
of
was
2000.
amazed at was this was the time when you were still at HBS, is that right? So you were doing this while attending courses in the morning and
Yeah.
yeah. How do you manage building a startup while doing a full-time MBA?
It was challenging. I think, if you ask some of my close friends and business school classmates, they'll say they didn't see a lot of me that first half of 2012, which was, really kind of the closing term of our MBA. It was challenging in the sense of trying to balance all the different priorities. The time, business school is different than I think law school or med school or other graduate schools, where the coursework in and of itself is extremely intensive. There's certainly elements of that, no doubt, with business school, but it's really more of a, it's an environment where people get to choose where they want to focus their energy. So that could be the classroom, that could be networking and finding your next job, that could be working on interesting research projects with, some of the best professors in the world. That could be starting your own business, right? So it was about choosing from all these different priorities and recognizing that there's a trade-off. And that trade-off for me was, spending less time in the classroom or on coursework, I should say, right? And spending more time building the business. So I'd spend, I'd go to class, in the mornings, try to kind of front load my course, my class schedule to mornings. Then in the afternoons, I'd go over to the Harvard Innovation Lab, which is a sort of just brand new structure they had built to encourage people within the Harvard community to start companies and to interact with people from all the other schools. So I'd be there from, let's say 12 to 7, kind of working away at the startup, come home, try to get some classwork done, and sort of go back and forth. So I wouldn't say it was easy, but it was about picking and choosing where I wanted to focus my time.
I'm looking at the 2012 June version of your website, and it's very simple. Right, it has just two columns. What's your legal headache? And there's a blank there, near, and there's a blank to find or to enter the area, like Boston, Massachusetts. And then there's a button, find a lawyer. I don't know if I'll be able to enter this information now because it's the archive, but what would happen if I'd entered something like, divorce and near Boston, Massachusetts?
Yeah, let's say there's a divorce near Boston, Massachusetts, find lawyers. You basically get a page or perhaps multiple pages of search results, which would show you sort of a card view of each of the lawyers that were on our platform. So it was kind of a closed network. Whoever had paid for our service would get showcased there. They would, you as the user would see a rating scale, right, to see how prior clients had rated them. So we would pre-populate each of these lawyer profiles with reviews that had come directly from prior clients of theirs. So we reach out to the clients and get direct reviews. And then, of course, anyone who had made an appointment could add reviews. You would see some pricing information, so you'd understand whether they offer free consultations, and for certain types of cases that were more common, what that would cost. So that was the other element that we were trying to introduce, was price transparency. And historically, the very black box process when trying to get fee information from lawyers. You'll have to get on a call. You'll often have to pay for that consultation before they'll even tell you what they charge. So to us, that was very backwards in sort of a world where price transparency is ubiquitous.
So with a lawyer, right? So it depends on how many hours he's trying to work on the process. For example, like divorce can take 1 hour or 20 hours, depending on the complexity. How would you give a price in this situation?
Yeah, so that's true in some cases, right? There's certain verticals and certain case types where they're not built on the hourly billing model. Immigration is a good example, right? In H-1B, sure, it may have some wrinkles, but the way lawyers quote fees for services like an H-1B or an L-1 are flat fee, because the reality is, you know, these are fairly standard processes, and you should be able to quote them accurately based on having done, you know, high volume of them. Similarly, for other areas of the law, sure, certainly not all divorces look the same, right? There's contested divorces and there's uncontested divorces and a lot of different wrinkles. So we would have a listing of these services such that, you know, an uncontested divorce would be X hundred or X thousand dollars, and make that very clear to allow users to compare. Of course, price is not the only factor. We understand that. But it helps understand what you're working with in terms of the set of providers that are available. So we'd include experience, we'd include reviews, we'd include prices, and basically help people make an educated choice as to what lawyer to connect with.
How do you get people on your platform to find these lawyers?
Well, that's where the challenges really came in, right? And probably, you know, one of my the biggest piece of advice I give to new entrepreneurs is to be maniacally focused on distribution. All right, the product is just one of so many things that need to go right for a business to really tick. And you know, obviously, we had thought about this and had ideas for this, but the execution challenges were huge. Trying to get consumers, not only get them to the site, but then get them to convert through the funnel was pretty challenging. To get them to the site, we tried a variety of different techniques, or different strategies. One was paid search, so kind of Google search ads, where we would do hyperlocal ads in different towns, not just in Boston generally, but you know, literally within each town in and around Boston. We would have direct advertisements, local ads that would be very specific and targeted. We'd even have workshops where people would come in. We would host them at this Harvard Innovation Lab in a classroom and get, you know, a dozen people in a room to talk about immigration or the H-1B process or whatever the case might be. We also did content marketing, right? So we wrote blog posts and tried to push out through our social channels, tried to push out content.
The
reality is, it's challenging. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, where the results came in were, you know, we could get people through the funnel, but it was more expensive than the actual, you know, cost of the actual revenue we were driving, which obviously doesn't work very well from a business perspective.
What was it while we were costing, do you remember?
$250. Yeah, let's say we were getting $250 a month from a lawyer. You know, it was costing us close to, you know, $500 or $750 to drive them that value, right? and the math isn't as straightforward, right? The reality is with the legal industry, if you bring one client over the course of 3 months, that's probably going to pay for the service because you're talking about, $1,000 transaction, right?
Yeah.
Or potentially more. So over the course of maybe the lawyer would give us a month and they didn't see any clients, right? Or maybe 2 months, but eventually they'd say, look, I've paid, close to $1,000 over 3 months and I've gotten some leads, right? Some people that are calling me or connecting with me, but these leads are not translating into clients. And so it was really kind of getting the whole funnel right, from getting people in the door to getting them to book a consultation to ultimately getting them to become a client.
Yeah.
Was really, really challenging.
So you were basically doing what a lawyer would do on his own, right?
Well, yeah, in most cases, lawyers wouldn't be doing this at all,
uh-huh.
right? So they just wouldn't be, most of the lawyer marketing is coming from word of mouth and, just within their own network, which is why most kind of small law firms stay fairly small, because they're really hard to grow. They're hard to differentiate yourself. So we were doing some of what they might not be doing at all, or replacing some of what they were doing. To your point, if they were paying for ads on their own, or we were basically building a platform
mm-hmm.
with the idea that there'd be network effects over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the key, that over, and this is exactly how ZocDoc started, right? You kind of build both sides, the supply and demand of the marketplace, and over time, the more lawyers there are, the more consumers actually want to use the platform, because it becomes kind of the trusted source. And the more consumers there are, the more lawyers are going to want to join the platform, right? So it's sort of this classic supply demand equation where you're always trying to move both sides in lockstep to be able to provide the right quality of service and to provide the value proposition you're promising.
So if you were spending more money than what the revenue that is coming, you had to change something, right? So what did you change?
Well, I think it, so that was part of it, right? We knew that sort of economically this was a challenging model, but this was early, so there was still this opportunity to say, look, maybe we can optimize. We at scale, your ads get more efficient, or we can find the right channels, or this is what most other venture backed companies do today. They're spending more money than they're generating in revenue. In hopes that at some future point they'll be able to be profitable. So it was less about the economic model. It was more about, we really didn't feel like we were solving the problem we originally set out to solve,
okay.
Which is actually changing how legal services are delivered, right? And actually changing the experience from the consumers or from the business, from the customer's perspective. Ultimately, all we were doing was connecting one side of the market to the other,
mm-hmm.
and then we sort of disappeared from the transaction. So I could connect you, Rohit, to a lawyer in Boston, and then you were on your own,
yeah.
right? You had to still go through this messy process and not have a lot of transparency and go through sort of an inefficient process. And we really couldn't control that outcome.
Yeah.
And that to us wasn't the business we set out to build.
I see. So there's no value that you're providing once, customer was signed up.
Exactly, right? We were just that front layer. Ultimately, we were a marketing platform for lawyers, which is not what we set out to build. We really set out to solve the consumer problem, and we weren't doing that through that V1 of the application.
So this was around September of 2012, and DACA was approved by Obama, right? So what happened when DACA
That's
was
right.
approved by Obama?
Well, so DACA was, DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This was a program that affected about 2 million undocumented immigrants in the country. It was basically President Obama passing an executive order to provide deportation relief for youth, right, that had come to the country before their 16th birthday, typically with their families. Kind of the idea being it was no fault of their own, and they're here, and they're They're doing all the things that they're supposed to be, so we shouldn't have this hanging over their head that they could get deported and they could have ICE come to their door any moment. It also gives them the opportunity to get a work permit. So the idea there and the opportunity we saw was, at the time, this is Forrest and I really sort of trying to explore. At the time, we our third co-founder, once we decided that we were going to move in a different direction, for several reasons, decided not to continue on the journey. And so it was Forrest and I at the time figuring out what was next. And we were very motivated to build something that actually improved the legal service process. So we had to go deeper into one specific area of the law. Immigration, given my history and given some of the business model dynamics around immigration, it allows itself or is positioned to be streamlined in a way that divorce or bankruptcy cannot do that. So we focus in on immigration, and this opportunity came up in the fall of 2012 with President Obama passing this, and we saw it as the perfect opportunity to pilot this idea we had around actually building sort of like a TurboTax for immigration, is the way the media initially sort of spun this. The idea being, we could build software, do-it-yourself software, that allows a user to come in, provide data, and the technology on the back end could populate forms, could put the entire application together, could suggest supporting documents to include in the application, and basically help someone who would otherwise either pay thousands of dollars to a lawyer or, in most cases, for this specific population, they were actually not using a lawyer at all. So it was really replacing this idea of you have to do this on your own by going to the USCIS website. Instead, we're going to give you a tool that's educated, that's vetted by lawyers, and give you the logic to be able to efficiently get through this process.
At this time, were you charging the users anything to use this platform?
Not initially. So we experimented with a few different pricing models, as most startups do early on. And ultimately, the direction we decided to go was we're going to make the actual workflow free, but at the end of the process, or at different points throughout the process, we're going to offer the opportunity to connect with lawyers to review the application, and before it's submitted to the government. And the reason for that was we had users and applicants that were saying, this software is really great, but I'm still, to the point that we talked about earlier in the conversation about the stakes being tremendously high for any immigration process. These applicants were saying, I don't want to screw this up. No matter how great any technology is, it's not going to give me the peace of mind I need that a lawyer can provide. And so that was an interesting opportunity where we said, okay, great. Let's see if we can get lawyers to bring their prices down by 80, 90% by our platform, our software, doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but still give them an opportunity as a lawyer to make a solid amount of fees for reviewing an application that was already completed. And for the applicant, that also gave them an opportunity to get that peace of mind. And so that was the pricing model, sort of freemium, where we could get a user through the workflow and they could upgrade, so to speak, to a lawyer review. And that's really sort of the start of how we got to this idea of a hybrid kind of technology plus services model.
So the attorneys, instead of charging $2,000, they would only charge 200 because instead of
Exactly.
taking 10 hours, it will only take them 1 hour to review the case. And
That's exactly right.
for the clients also, it's peace of mind because instead of taking the risk on themselves and filing DACA on their own, they have a lawyer looking at it and kind of approving it.
That's exactly right.
How many people applied through your platform in 2012 for DACA?
So we had about 2,000 or 2,500 people make it through the application workflow on our site, and this was within a period of about 3 months. So we were pretty encouraged by, you had this. Obviously, we had some things working in our favor with a new, completely new program that had this surge of demand, and we were doing, you know, really building a brand around helping this community through this process. But we, you know, I think that what was most validating was sort of the opportunity we were giving people who otherwise wouldn't have access to legal services.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually getting help in a world where otherwise they would have gone through this process on their own, and in many cases have made a mistake. We actually also, you know, one of the other key markers for us was 25% of DACA applicants were actually eligible for another form of relief. So they thought they were eligible for DACA, but they were actually eligible for something else. They had a grandparent who was a U.S. citizen, and they didn't realize that that could give them access to a green card through something called derivative citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had a family member of some sort, or they were perhaps the victim of abuse from a family member, and so they were eligible for other kinds of visas. So really that helped us identify that really the problem isn't just applying, but the problem is helping candidates screen and helping them understand what their immigration options are. So it's these kind of these points of validation that encouraged us to march forward, even though the revenue at the time wasn't particularly exciting. It was more about validating that this approach of combining technology and legal services could deliver the value that we were hoping to deliver.
So at this time, you still hadn't raised any money, right? We are in 2013 now, and you are still basing it out of the revenue you were making and your own money. Was it? How was it financially in this time?
It was, you know, it was challenging, right? At the time, you know, I always think the challenges of entrepreneurship are both related to the business, and the lines ultimately blur between your business and your family life as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me personally, my wife had our first kid in the fall of 2012. So literally, you know, in the middle of this DACA madness, you know, where we're, you know, up for 10 nights straight and, you know, really trying to build this product, get it off the ground, try to just hustle as much as we can. In the middle of all this, I have a newborn at home.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I've moved back to San Francisco. Forrest is still in Boston, right? He you know, for him, you know, we hadn't raised any money yet. It was too risky for him to pick up and come out to San Francisco. So we're on opposite coasts. I have, you know, a baby at home. My wife is effectively, you know, supporting us financially through that period, through her job. Really, really challenging time. I think a really sort of a key moment for us in terms of kind of the make or break stage of the company was marching through in spite of these challenges, both on kind of the professional and the personal side.
Yeah. Like we were talking earlier, right? So a lot of people talk about their successes, and but everyone goes through struggle, and I appreciate you talking about them.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So we were in the end of 2013, and you had these financially difficult times, but there was, and you were in San Francisco, I believe, to raise money, right? And how did your efforts pan out?
Yeah, so, you know, this is now 2013. We, you know, had the DACA test, as I'll call it, the DACA test behind us. We were building other family-based applications on the back of that. We basically said, okay, let's build a platform that's focused not just on DACA, but can help someone through the citizenship process, can help them through the family-based green card process, and several other kind of individual immigration options that don't require an employer sponsor, and build kind of a similar service model as what we had delivered with DACA. At the same time, while and we're trying to build and trying to grow, we also realized that it was ready to raise. We were ready to raise some money. We had already validated some of the key assumptions, and knew that for us to move forward at the pace we needed to move forward at, we actually needed to build more of an infrastructure, build a team, et cetera. So we spent a good chunk of 2013 fundraising. I this was pretty much my full-time job, was fundraising for maybe 6 months to raise our seed round. And obviously we're trying to balance that with, I'm trying to duck back into the product and try to support customers and do all those types of things while I'm doing that. So that was, fundraising is, it's a hell of a process. I think anyone who tells you otherwise, would be lying to you. It's thrilling. It's challenging. You learn so much about yourself and how you take no's, right? Because the reality is, you talk to 100 investors, at least 90% of them are probably going to say no. So you have to find the believers, and really kind of stay focused. It was a challenging process, but we came out of it successfully. And that was, kind of a really just key moment. I think probably the first kind of milestone moment, for the company. I think getting through raising, we had raised a total of $800,000, by the end of 2014. Mm-hmm. Basically closed our round on December 31st of 2013. We raised from a few seed funds as well as a number of angels. Mm-hmm. And some really great investors who I think believed at the time in really what we were building. Everyone is touched by their own immigrant story, whether it's as a business owner, as a foreign national themselves, someone in your family. And so it was a mission that a lot of people cared about, which I think helped our fundraising efforts.
Is this also the time when you moved from Lexpot.com to Bridge.us?
Right after raising the round, we then moved to, we did a rebranding effort. We brought on someone to lead our marketing effort. We brought on someone to lead our kind of legal content efforts, someone who had actually been in the immigration space for a lot longer than Forrest and I had been. Mm-hmm. We brought on some folks to kind of supercharge some of these efforts that were just moving too slowly, frankly, without the time to actually invest in them.
Got it.
So a big one of those was this rebranding to Bridge US.
Yeah, now that you had funding, you could afford to hire all these people to work on it full time.
Exactly.
Is this when you moved out of the family based immigration towards more business side?
Yeah, it was shortly after raising the round. So, kind of we knew after we raised the round that the opportunity, we'd always had our eyes on the business opportunity, but the product wasn't there yet. The product has to be much more complex. The process is much more complex when you are moving into the B2B space, not only because you have a more sophisticated customer that has a demands a higher level of professionalism and the product has to really be up to par with what they expect from all of their service providers, mm-hmm. But the process itself, right? When you go through an employment-based immigration process, you have a foreign national employee. You have typically an HR professional or some employer representative. You have a lawyer. So you have a lot of different parties that all need to play together in one process. And so the product really had to evolve from a single user application to this multi-user application and really required some heavy development resources to do that. So we invested a big chunk of 2014 in getting that application ready, not just from the product perspective, but getting the right service providers in place, right? Our service is reliant on, and what makes it so powerful is the relationships we have with some of the top immigration attorneys in the country. And so, without that, the service has no legs. Yeah. And so, we were building those relationships, alongside building the product. Getting our marketing in line, all of that, and then eventually launched in the fall of 2014. Had some great press, CNN coverage, and other coverage that was helpful in kind of jumpstarting our marketing efforts.
What was the
and
October
help
launch,
in a couple.
like October version? What did it have when you launched in October of 2014 for the H-1B application? What did it look like if you were to go through the flow?
Yeah, so initially it was only the H-1B, right? In many ways, it was similar to our product today, but just an earlier version of it. So it allowed all three parties in this process to collaborate in an efficient and transparent way. So we could invite a company and an employee to an H-1B process. The employee could provide their data and documents on our cloud-based platform. The company could do the same. All parties could track the status of the process. Everything was completely paperless, so there's no need to print, sign, mail, do all those different pieces of the process that can be fairly cumbersome. And then as a company, you could also track all of your foreign national employees. So let's say you're a company that has 20 foreign nationals, you could track their current immigration status, their expiration. You could track some key data for each of those foreign nationals. And basically, it was a life cycle solution, certainly with fewer of the kind of advanced features that we have now today. And the reality is a lot of what was happening when a process was live, when we were actually working on a case, was happening in the background by the legal team. So the software was kind of, a nice kind of user-facing view. But in terms of the actual automation and the efficiency of the process, that really hadn't been built into our platform at launch.
So how was it happening when you said the legal time, there were lawyers in the back end taking all this data? I mean, your value proposition for the lawyers was that it'll save them time also, right? But this seems to be
Right.
contradicting.
Yeah, so we had paralegals on our team that were taking a lot of this information, and certainly there was some automation built in, but our team was doing basically the job that, in some ways, the job that the software will ultimately do kind of in a later version of an application like the one we have today. But the software was doing some portion of it, and then there was a paralegal, an experienced immigration paralegal on our side, who was putting things together for the lawyer to then review, so that we were hacking at that value proposition initially,
Got it.
which I think you'll see a lot of startups do, kind of pretend like there's more automation than there is initially, and then build so that you can actually deliver that.
So you launched in October of 2014, and you launched with the H-1B application, like you mentioned a minute ago. But October is not the time when H-1s are being filed, right? So I'm
Right.
assuming, how did the next year H-1 season go? Actually, can you tell us what the season is and how the product did during that time?
Sure. So H-1B cap season is basically the one time, the once a year period where a new H-1B applicant can apply for the H-1B lottery. So there's 200 and this year there was 235,000 people that applied, but there was only 85,000 spots. So there's a lottery system that actually where the government selects who gets whose applications they'll actually review. And so that the time period for that is, basically companies are applying in, let's say, January, February, March, for an April 1st deadline. And throughout the rest of the year, you can still apply for H-1Bs, but only if you already have an H-1B. So if you're doing an H-1B extension or a transfer. But really our focus was on these companies that were going to apply for new H-1Bs. And like you said, so we launched in October, pretty quickly we're running into the holidays in November and December. And so we really only had January, February, March to actually reach out to new prospects and to close customers ahead of the April 1st deadline. So it's a pretty tight time frame, and we just went on a complete sales tear. Really kind of our fastest growing period in those first few years of the company, where we literally reached out to hundreds and hundreds of companies. And just started talking to them about their immigration process and what challenges they had and what frustrations they had. and presented our solution. And ultimately, we ended up selling, probably had 50 companies on board for that first H-1B CAP season, which is pretty remarkable, kind of going from a literally a standing start where we had, zero customers and didn't have a product until October for the business offering to, selling companies, not just startups, right? Obviously, here in the Valley, in Silicon Valley, we have a lot of startups around us that were interested in what we were doing. But we were also able to sell to larger, sort of mid-sized corporations, that were doing, up to, let's say, 65 or 70 H-1B applications, that season, right? That March, and charging them, anywhere between $1,000 and $2,000 to do so. So we really, that was kind of our, a key period of growth for us where we could actually get customers on board, get feedback on the product, improve the product, and actually start building a real business.
How many H-1B applications did your platform do in 2015 season?
I think just that March, which is kind of the key period, for H-1B season, we did, over 200. So, just to kind of put that into context, you'll have most firms with, many different, let's say, a typical boutique immigration firm with, 10 to 20 people may not do 200 applications in one CAP season. So it was, while that was exciting, it put a real strain, on us as a company because we were playing catch up. With, you go from zero reps or let's say single digit reps, ahead of H-1B season, where maybe we did a transfer here, an extension there, and then all of a sudden you multiply that by, 100, and do that all in 1 month. We were basically sleeping in the office, up until 3 or 4 in the morning. Looking back, it's fun, it's entertaining, it was sort of a galvanizing moment for the company and the folks that were here with us at the time. But at the time, it was not particularly pretty internally. From our client's perspective, it was great. I mean, for them, they didn't actually see how the sausage was getting made behind the scenes. But for us, it was a pretty cumbersome and pretty tiring process that first H-1B CAP season.
So I guess the cumbersome part is the lack of automation, right? Which you decided to deal with in the first one. So after the H1 season, I believe April 1st, everyone applies for H1. Then there is a slow period by the end of 20, after April 2015. So what did you do during that time? Did you develop and enhance the system more?
Well, it's funny. It wasn't as slow as we expected, right? We all of a sudden, these clients that were so happy with, that experience, those first couple of months, were then saying, "Oh, by the way, I need to file this H-1B extension, or do you do L-1 visas? And how can you help me with a TN visa? Or I need to get someone through the green card process." And so all of a sudden, we were not only sort of trying to optimize our H-1B workflow, but we were also trying to build other workflows to support our customers. Because they had needs beyond just this one simple application that we've built. So, it was part optimization and part growth. The optimization piece, yeah, it was very much, I spent, my personally spent a lot of time really looking at every single step in the H-1B process and figuring out how we can make it more efficient, and easier for our customer. Not only for our customer, but also for the internal team. So we looked at every single thing someone was doing and try to figure out if we could build something that would make that process easier, whether that was populating templates for support letters, whether that was populating forms, whether that was just better instructions at different points in the process. So it was really, kind of looking inward, whereas the first kind of 3 months of the year was very much looking outward and trying to sell customers. We then had to sort of, secure the house, so to speak. And make sure everything was working well internally.
So, 2016 season, how did that actually, sorry, before I go into 2016 season, what other workflows did you build in 2015?
Yeah, so in 2015, we built really the majority of the remaining workflows that consume 95% of corporate immigration work. So, you know, your typical company is going to go through H-1Bs that we had already built, TN visas, which are for Canadian and Mexican nationals, E3 visas for people from Australia. You have L1 visas, which are pretty high volume, which are for intra-company transfers, so bringing people that a company that has offices abroad and offices in the U.S., moving employees to the U.S. from foreign locations. And then the different stages of the green card process.
Mm-hmm.
So the green card process is typically three stages. You had to build those three stages. So it was really, you know, building it out so that we could support, you know, almost all corporate immigration processes.
Wow.
So that's really, you know, that was what was great is we had built the infrastructure to be able to do that much more efficiently. So a lot of the same tools we were using were just repurposed towards a new workflow. We had built a kind of our workflow builder that Forrest had built, kind of our back-end authoring tool, became very flexible and became a core technology asset for the company.
So doing all the things that you mentioned, that's a pretty comprehensive list, right? And each one has its own nuances, which is what mm-hmm. makes the lawyer's job as valuable. How did you guys go through building the same workflows in a technology platform?
Yeah. So it was a lot of time spent with immigration experts, right? Mm. People have been doing this for decades.
Mm.
So that included our immigration attorneys, right? That have been literally, you know, some of who have been practicing for 25 years, really kind of relied on their expertise in terms of, you know, what a workflow needed to look like. And, you know, these are people that have done tens of thousands of these processes. So they live and breathe immigration. It was also, you know, whether that was attorneys or paralegals, you know, these are people that really knew the process inside and out. So we relied on them to in terms of the content. And then, of course, the actual building of the workflow, that was kind of our own product team focused on implementing those suggestions.
What did you do in revenue for 2015?
So 2015 was about $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was just really the vast majority of that was that first H-1B season. Right? We were really focused on that H-1B cap. And then, like you said, the rest of the year was really spent internally. We didn't have the capacity to go out and get new business. We were so focused in internally.
I see. Now, how many people were there at this time by the end of 2015 in your company?
We had about 5 people.
I see.
At that point.
Oh, wow. So, it's an incredible, like the leverage is very high, right? 300K in revenue, 200 applications filled with just 5 people team and external attorneys.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's interesting about, you know, immigration. It's a relatively, in the legal space in general, mm-hmm. it's a high ticket transaction.
Yeah.
So most of the time you hear 200 applications, you're like, you know, we don't spend more than, you know, $25 on anything in our lives anymore, right? In terms of services online.
Yeah.
And then when you realize that the ticket size is $1,000, $2,000 or more, that's when the leverage kicks in. And so, you're exactly right. We had a good amount of leverage at the time. And really 2016 is a further extension of that leverage.
Yeah. Tell us more about 2016. How did it go?
2016 was great. You know, after a tough 2012, 2013, kind of finding ourselves, a 2014 where we could celebrate the launch of a new product, but couldn't show a whole lot for it in terms of revenue. 2015, you know, adding our first customers, which is always exciting. And then you have to figure out, you know, are we going to be a real company, right? Is this just a fun little project? Or can you actually become a serious business?
Mm-hmm.
And 2016 proved that that was the case. We moved from signing up SMBs, so kind of small and medium-sized businesses, to in addition to supporting SMBs, kind of graduated to larger kind of enterprise companies.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone from, you know, Coca-Cola to American Family Insurance. You had these Fortune 500 type companies
mm-hmm.
that we couldn't have dreamed of, you know, even, a year and a half ago. Suddenly, early this year, as we build traction and as our solution gets more and more refined, and as we have customers talking to us, to other potential customers, you really start, we started to build, this great pipeline from a sales perspective, and get these companies on board that didn't just need, one or two visas every year, but we're talking about kind of, 100 plus cases and have, thousands and thousands of total employees,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a league that we had never been in before.
I see.
And so that's been great for us this year, kind of graduating into the larger enterprises while continuing to serve smaller companies, broadening our portfolio of services that we could offer to these companies, and fine tuning our internal process so that there's not as much stress on our team. And we really have a very, very sort of streamlined process that allows us to spend a lot more time with our clients, actually answering questions and doing things like that, as opposed to, kind of gathering paperwork and data entry and those types of things.
I see. That's what allowed you to go over $1 million in revenue for 2016, which you talked about at the beginning of the interview.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what advice do you have, Romesh, for others who are just starting out?
It's a good question. I mean, I think, entrepreneurship is if not 50%, probably more than 50% mental.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of this is sort of the psychology of entrepreneurship and how you stay balanced and how you get through the lows, the inevitable lows. And then the other part is, of course, business execution. So, I think on the psychological piece, so to speak, I'd say to expect that things are going to take, three times as long, and your growth is going to be three times slower.
Mm-hmm.
And really sort of realize that this is really a journey and not an overnight success.
Mm-hmm.
So few companies are built overnight and look like, a Snapchat or something like that, especially B2B companies, right? That really require a lot of investment, building out a sales team. They're less likely to catch fire than some consumer companies. And even on the consumer side, very few overnight successes. And I think we're surrounded by media that tells us otherwise because those are the fun stories. And I think you have to be very patient and be focused on a problem that you care about solving, as I mentioned earlier, as opposed to just this idea of, I want to run my own business, I want to be my own boss, sort of these ideas of what entrepreneurship means.
Sorry. I was going to say, even the others which are not overnight successes, which are portrayed by the media as such. So, for example, yours, media would probably portray it as an overnight success, but you went through a struggle of 2 to 3 solid years before you got to where you did, right?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. And then on the business side, I'd say, as I touched on earlier, you just have to have this. I just strongly encourage entrepreneurs to, spend 90% of their time thinking about distribution.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many entrepreneurs are fixated on the product, and they'll be so excited about, building this great product that's going to do this, and it's going to change the way. This is how people do it today, but this is why my solution is so much better. The reality is, if you can't get your product or service in the hands of customers, nothing matters, right? We see this every day, right? You see huge companies, right? I think most of us would argue that, is Oracle the best software in every industry that they compete in? The reality is probably not, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's all these great startups that are competing, but they don't get the traction because they can't get their foot in the door and actually be able to surface that product or service to that customer. So whether you're operating in a B2B space or B2C space, spend all your time or nearly all your time thinking about how you're actually going to get your product or service in the hands of customers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see a lot of examples of companies that have actually subpar products, but because of really smart and innovative distribution strategies, their market leaders are growing incredibly quickly. So on the business side, that would kind of be my key advice.
It reminds me of the article that I read about how McDonald's, how probably anyone can make a better burger than McDonald's, but still McDonald's is billions of dollars worth because they have a better distribution system. So for people who are listening to us, they want to connect with you, what is the best way to do so, Ramesh?
Well, feel free to shoot me an email. You know, I think if you're a business that's interested in our services or learning more about what we do, you can always go to www.bridge.us and go to our business landing page, which will allow you to set up a introductory phone call and demo through our scheduling service that's on the site. If you're just interested in personally connecting to me, I'm always happy to chat with whether it's foreign entrepreneurs or any entrepreneurs for that matter, anyone that's interested in what we're doing. You can always shoot me an email at romish@bridge.us, my first name at bridge.us, and I'd be more than happy to connect.
I will leave your email in the show notes. Are you on Twitter by any chance, Romish?
I am as well, yeah.
Yeah, what is your Twitter handle?
Romish and Badani.
Okay.
I'll shoot you a link after as well. But
great.
Yeah,
sounds
my
good.
First name, middle initial, last name.
I will include that in the show notes as well. Romish, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, bro, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day. Oh, my God.